We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Lots to cover, starting with the Kent teachers are on strike.
Yeah, and the school board for the city of Kent seems, pretty firmly determined, not necessarily to have classes, but to break the union, whether we have classes or not. They put out a notice now that classes will be resuming on Monday, even though they don't have an agreement yet. And the reason for this is a judicial ruling that came yesterday that said Kent teachers will be fined retroactively $200 a day for every day since September 8th of classes they miss if they do not report for work on Monday. Well, this came even though the teachers union offered the Kent School District what it says was a package worth $200,000 less than the Kent District's original offer. That was on Thursday, and the teachers assumed fairly rationally that would lead to some sort of a compromise and then the issue would be resolved. Well, that didn't take into account one particularly critical element of this story, which is the determination by the city of Kent to break the teachers union.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting in this is all that was at issue last weekend when the teachers were trying to decide whether or not they were going to go on strike. The only thing that was outstanding that was still on the table was class size. And the teachers union had made
money. Money was not even particularly an issue.
Yeah, they had agreed with the district on what the pay raises should be. They'd figured out all of their work days and everything. The only thing that was still at issue was class size. And in the Kent School District, there are a lot of students who speak English as a second language, and they struggle in class. And the Kent teachers had a point. You know, it is hard to teach 30 students when half of them only speak English as a second language. It's not their native language. And you keep piling more and more students on us, it makes it really hard. We end up being babysitters a lot of the time. And so they had a point, and they also pointed out that the Kent School District is not broke. It has, in fact, a pretty good cash surplus in savings, and certainly can afford a couple $1 million to reduce class sizes. Their cash savings is up in the tens of millions of dollars, so they could afford to spend a couple $1 million to help the teachers out and to make it so that students get a quality education, not just sitting there waiting for other students in class to understand what's going on. So when the teachers made their offer, they said, look, we will give back. They made an offer on Thursday. They said, okay, look, this is ridiculous that we're on strike the first week of school. We will give back some of our pay increase. We will give back the stipends that the district offered if you do something about class size. And they assumed that, we gave a little bit. The district should be able to deal with that compromise. And the school board simply said, no, we're not even looking at your offer. It's our way or the highway. And that's just ridiculous. Fortunately, the teachers union is filing an unfair labor practice complaint against the school board and the school district for not bargaining in good faith. And I hope they appeal the court ruling too
it's a very bad precedent.
Yeah, that's a really bad precedent that I've never seen a court go after a teachers union like this before.
Yeah, and a couple other quick thoughts on that. One is that in the district sense, it's a very penny-wise and found foolish approach to trying to break the teachers union, because if I'm a prospective teacher looking at, well, the union tried to reduce the class size, and they're looking out for the interests of the kids, and the district doesn't particularly seem to be, and the kind of disrespect that comes from not only not bargaining with the union, but basically trying to break the union and trying to get trying to go to court and get that kind of a punitive approach to how it treats its own employees. Why on earth would, and goodness knows there's no shortage of different districts where you can work, and teaching in public schools is a very difficult and thankless job to begin with. Why on earth would I want to go to work for the Kent teachers?
For the Kent School District.
I think they're going to have a harder time recruiting teachers in the future. And part of the stipends in the first place was because the Kent District has had a hard time retaining teachers.
Yeah, it's a growing district, and they're going to need more teachers in the future, and it's going to be hard for them to find them if they treat them like this.
Yeah, and the other thing that I just wanted to point out is this once again is what happens when we have a one newspaper city, because that newspaper is the reflexively anti-union Seattle Times, and it has its coverage of this standoff has been very one-sided.
It's been
very bad.
Yeah, and you know, local TV stations haven't been much better. I think I was watching Channel 7 last night, Cairo, and they were talking about how they interviewed a member of the school board and they interviewed a representative from the teachers union, but they didn't point out the key fact, which is that Kent is not broke. It's not a school district that's having problems balancing its budget. In fact, has a surplus. And that's a pretty key and important piece of information to leave out of the reporting.
All right. Well, speaking of unions, they're not just having problems there in Kent. Boeing and Charleston had an interesting development this week.
Yeah, Charleston, South Carolina, the International Association of Machinists has been decertified at the plant there that was owned by Voight Aircraft. Boeing bought Voight last summer, and therefore the contract that Boeing inherited, they had the opportunity to get it decertified, and Boeing pushed very hard for this decertification. Ironically, distributed anti-union material had union members, and mind you, we're only talking about, you know, a couple hundred people here, subjected them to anti-union harangues and so forth. One of the things that Boeing, ironically enough, was playing on and tried to stoke up the resentment of the union about was that the IAM settled for such a poor contract when it had a contract last year, because the certification originally happened 2 years ago, and the IAM had to get in a contract within a year or it would lose its certification. So they settled for a very poor contract, and Boeing played that up, saying, "See, the IAM didn't do you right. They didn't give you a good contract. Well, now there's no union contract at all. You can be sure that Boeing is going to do its best to make sure that there won't be any other union contract to replace it with, and they're going to use that as leverage also to try and insist on a no strike clause and get as favorable as possible a settlement with the IAM when the contract comes due here in Seattle."
Yeah, this gives Boeing a non-union plant to kind of hold over the heads of the local IAM and say, "Look, we want concessions now, or else we'll take our business elsewhere." And that's not such good news.
Yeah, particularly because even though Boeing, many of its production problems with the Dreamliner, the 787, and so forth, have come from outsourced work, from work in non-union shops, etc., that seems to be less important to Boeing management than breaking the unions.
Yeah, and, it wouldn't be the first time that Boeing had shot itself in the foot. I mean, outsourcing jobs on the Dreamliner project, even outsourcing the fuselage work to this plant in Charleston where, the workers are not as well trained. They don't have the same experience as workers here in Washington. And, it's the workers here in Washington that are fixing the problems that, have cropped up in production in the Charleston plant, because they've made their share of mistakes on the Dreamliner as well. And so if Boeing decides in the end it's going to build its second Dreamliner plant in Charleston, well, I would sell. If you own Boeing stock, I would sell it.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on to Greg Nichols looking for some more money for the streetcar.
Oh, yeah. Mayor Nichols went to the city council this week and said, "Help, you know, the streetcar ridership is up a tiny bit, I have to say. Ridership is up, but our debts are up, too." And that's no big surprise, because the city had to take out a $2.2 million loan in order to get the streetcar running in 2007. Now Mayor Nichols wants an additional $1.45 million in order to continue operation on the streetcar line. And he says that that's a loan that will be repaid between 2018 and 2023. But, you know, every loan has interest, and I don't really understand how this is going to work, the city paying itself interest, but he wants to take out a loan from other, quote-unquote, other city accounts, although he didn't specify which. This comes in a year when the mayor has asked the city employees to go on an unpaid furlough in order to close the budget gap, and has closed public libraries for a week. We're cutting into other city accounts already. Other city accounts already to close the budget loophole. Now he wants $1.5 million for the streetcar. It just does not
make
sense.
For Paul Allen's streetcar, we should specify.
Yeah. And we should say, you know,
This is not a transportation issue. This is a neighborhood development issue.
Yes, exactly.
The streetcar was used as infrastructure to make development more palatable there. It has nothing to do with the transportation plan for the city.
Yeah, and I should also point out, too, that the original estimates for revenue that the streetcar would bring in were grossly inflated because, as it turns out, the advertising revenue they've collected is about half of what they initially estimated. There's been no enforcement of fare paying on the South Lake Union trolley, and it's not set up even to accept the Puget Pass, you know, the bus passes that we buy for Metro and other systems in the Puget Sound region. It's not set up to accept the Orca card that's used on the new light rail system. So it's like, you know, clearly it's not meant to be a functioning
If anybody happens to actually ride the thing, that's a bonus. The important part is that it's there and you can use that to lure, you know, biotech.
That's
the whole idea.
Yeah, and the ridership, you know, they had said, oh, we expect 4,000 to 5,000 people to ride it. Well, the ridership is about 1,300 people a day. That's less than a quarter of the number of people who would ride one bus route, one metro bus route in the city of Seattle. So it's really not fulfilling the purpose that they built it for. It should be mothballed.
No, it's not fulfilling the purpose that it was claimed that they would build it for.
Right. All right, moving on. Update on referendum 71.
Yeah, this week Thurston County Judge Thomas McPhee ruled on Tuesday that the questionable signatures for referendum 71 were valid and he was not going to throw them out. Then U.S. District Judge Benjamin Settle granted a preliminary injunction Thursday to block release of the names of the people who signed the referendum. That means that it's pretty clear he is, in the end, going to probably decide in favor of keeping those signatures secret, and that could have an impact on future referendums in regards to the state's Public Records Act, which requires the release of most information in regards to political campaigns. The Secretary of State had also interpreted that to mean that the signatures on referendums were a matter of public record too. Well, this decision that the judge made could have an impact on that in the future. So we'll see how that goes. In the meantime, it looks like referendum 71 is going on the ballot for November.
Yeah, there's actually not been that much question, I think, for the past month or so that it's going to be on the ballot. Both the campaigns, pro and anti, have been gearing up on that assumption. And it's really too bad because it's going to be this massive waste of time and energy trying to decide essentially, you know, a question that voters have no right to be able to decide.
Well, that our Constitution should specify equal rights for everyone, regardless of race, sex, gender, and whether or not you are gay or lesbian or straight.
All right, moving on to national, and the president gave a healthcare speech this week.
You lie! Sorry. No, I'm not actually sorry at all. I'm going to go run for office and collect campaign donations now.
Yeah, President Obama gave his regular annual address to Congress, and he used it as a chance to try to push for health care reform. It was a real disappointment, I think, his speech, because I thought he was going to stand up there and say, this is what I want Congress to pass. Basically, all he did was he stood up there and said, well, this is what's in the plans that have been passed by the committees in the House of Representatives. And he left the door open for some major changes to the plan, basically doing some backpedaling. He said that he wants it to include a public option, but the way he phrased it is he called it a not-for-profit public option. And that can mean a lot of things. And he said later in the speech that he was leaving the door open for the Senate to hammer out a compromise, that not-for-profit option could include a co-op or nonprofit entity. It could mean a government-administered plan, or it could mean the trigger option, which would mean that a public plan would only go into effect if the healthcare exchange doesn't reduce costs. So he really left the door open on that.
Yeah, and also, especially with the trigger option, there's no question of when, or there's no statement as to when any of this is actually going to come into effect. It could be another 10 years before we see any of this.
Yeah, before we see an actual public option that would have some kind of effect for people. He did point out that we've spent way more. This was the good part of the speech because I've been watching all this discussion about, oh, we can't pass health care reform because it's going to add to the deficit, blah, 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 blah. And I just scratch my head and look at that and I go, you know, as an accountant, this just makes no sense to me at all. People are not protesting the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we're pouring money down that like we're flushing money down the toilet. And yet, you know, we talk about doing something for ourselves that makes sense, like making sure everybody has health care coverage, and we can't spend a penny on that. I don't get it. So he did point that out. He said that we are spending way more money on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan than we will ever spend on this health care reform plan, and I totally agreed with that. But that was towards the end of the speech, and, you know, if you'd been listening to it, wasn't in the meat of it, and if you'd been listening to it, you would have probably been asleep by that time.
And the remarkable thing afterwards of the media coverage of Obama's speech is that none of this was deconstructed in the media coverage. It was all about Joe Wilson and the decorum of interrupting the president and yada. And it's no wonder that we have so many people who are grossly ignorant about what the actual content of these various healthcare reform proposals are, because number one, we have, you know, media coverage that does not actually include any of the details of how this would impact people's lives or what the differences are between the different plans, what the approaches would mean, the bottom line. And then we have politicians and their supporters spreading active disinformation, also called lies, in order to try and derail the process. It's no wonder a lot of people are scared and confused.
Right. And, you know, it's traditional that when a president gives an address from, you know, he gives it from the perspective of his own party, usually the opposing party in Congress gives their own response to his address. Well, the Republican response to the president's speech was about as lame as you can get. It was a reiteration of a lot of the lies we've been hearing from Republican politicians and pundits about the plans that are in Congress, and basically gave no competing, you know, proposal.
Well, they haven't given a proposal in months.
Yeah, and that's been the Republican plan, is not to pass any kind of health care reform, not to come up with a valid competing plan or even any good ideas about what to do to change the health care reform system. It's merely to shoot down anything the Democrats put up.
All right.
So, and I thought it was interesting that the media didn't cover that aspect of it at all.
All right. Moving on to the Census Bureau has come out with a report.
Yeah, the Census Bureau released its annual report on Thursday showing, just the day after the president's speech, showing that now 46.3 million people are uninsured, and that's about 15.4% of the American population. But those are numbers that count the uninsured through December 2008. It doesn't capture all the people who have lost their jobs in the first 8 months of 2009. So that if you included all of those folks as well, that means it's probably closer to 50 million people, or one-sixth of the American population, that is uninsured. What was also interesting about these Census Bureau figures is that employer-based health insurance has decreased through December 2008 from 177.4 million. It's now down to 176.3 million. That's about 58% of the population. That's just a bare majority of the population. The difference, about 77.5 million people are covered by government programs, and that's a number that is growing. That's more than a quarter of the population, and that number is getting bigger. And that's without any kind of health care reform. So when you hear people say, oh, we don't want people covered by a government plan, et cetera, well, more than a quarter of the population is currently covered by government plans, and more people every day are being covered by government plans under the current system. So why can't we opt for a single-payer system?
Yeah.
Well, Obama said it in his healthcare speech before Congress. He said our main goal, he said it right off the bat, our main goal is to protect jobs, and to do that we have to protect the insurance industry.
Yeah, an insurance industry that, by any kind of standard of effective health care, not to mention the moral standard of, you know, what has happened with plans that have been retroactively canceled and coverage that has been denied, and people that have died as a result. The health insurance industry should be abolished in this country. They are responsible for that, and they have. I'm sorry, when you actively kill thousands and thousands of people each year, you have no right to do business.
Yeah, you should be.
Usually,
down.
We throw people in jail for something like
and
that.
And I don't understand this. Oh, I love the insurance industry. We can't do away with the insurance industry. That would be terrible. I don't understand that. I have no problem doing away with the insurance industry.
I have yet to talk to anybody who has had a good experience with the health insurance industry. And
yeah, where do their defenders come from?
I don't get it.
Among ordinary people. I understand that the insurance industry has a lot of money for lobbying, and they pay a lot of money into campaign coffers for lots and lots of politicians, but I don't understand where ordinary people can sit there and say, oh, you're doing away with the insurance industry. That's going to make me cry. I don't understand that.
All right, moving on. The corporations having their day in court this week, at least at the Supreme Court.
Yeah, speaking of one of the main reasons why the healthcare reform movement has been so difficult in this country, namely the campaign contributions that insurance companies are putting into the and their allies are putting into the pockets of lawmakers. U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments on Wednesday in a case that really could turn the political system in this country on its ear. In the case of Citizens United versus the Federal Elections Commission, and this remember that name, Citizens United versus the FEC, the Supreme Court has expanded what was originally a relatively narrow legal question in the case to include the question of whether corporations should be allowed to directly give money to political campaigns. They have been barred from doing so for over a century. The oldest of the laws that would be overturned under this decision was passed in 1907, and this is known in legal terms as settled precedent. The U.S. Supreme Court has come to this question time and time again, based a number of other precedents on this precedent. So, you know, when you hear conservatives bemoaning, you know, quote unquote activist judges, they don't seem to have any problem with activist judges who do what they want them to do. And this would very much be a case of legal overreaching by the conservative majority on the Supreme Court under Justice Roberts, and goes back once again to what we were talking about at the time, how this would be paying dividends for a long, long time when the Democrats rolled over on the nominations of Alito and Roberts. This is a very, very dangerous case and one to keep an eye on, because if corporations can directly give money to political campaigns, all bets are off in terms of if you think the politicians are bought and paid for right now, just imagine what it would be like under a system like that.
I mean, it goes right to the notion of what is democracy. Is democracy everyone has an equal vote, or is democracy rule by the rich? And that's what it would be if you had corporations and their CEOs and their rich shareholders deciding who gets elected and who doesn't.
All right. Moving on to international and developments in Afghanistan.
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about developments in the Afghan election. The UN-backed Electoral Complaints Commission this week threw out votes from 83 polling stations and ordered a total recount at hundreds of others in Kandahar, Ghazni, and Paktika province. That's three provinces that make up the heartland of Karzai's support. Hamid Karzai has been declared by the government-run Electoral Commission as having won more than 50% of the vote. Again, those are people who were appointed by Karzai. In the polling centers that the UN-backed Electoral Complaints Commission have already examined in some of those regions in Kandahar, they found evidence of ballot stuffing at all of the polling stations they've examined in the Sherabak district. In Spin Boldak, they found that two-thirds of the polling places checked have shown signs of ballot box stuffing. In lots of the places where the government reported 100% or more voter turnout, they found that when they asked eyewitnesses at those polling stations, they said that almost nobody showed up on voting day.
They didn't need to.
Oh, no, they didn't, because the government was going to vote for them. That's particularly true in large areas of Nuristan, Paktika, Helmand, and Baghdas provinces, again, places that were expected to widely support Hamid Karzai. So it could take months to do a recount of these places. And it's not clear that all of the places where massive fraud went on are going to be recounted.
What's the purpose of a recount when it's not? The question isn't whether the votes were counted accurately; it's whether the ballots were stuffed in the first place.
What they do is they go back and they verify that these were actual real ballots, and people came in and signed the register and voted. So they could end up throwing out 99% of the votes in some of these polling places. What's interesting is that there's been a lot of pressure on Abdullah, the other main candidate, to form a unity government with Karzai. He announced this week that he wouldn't do that, and that's setting us up for a potential runoff if enough votes are thrown out. Well, there's problems with that, too. That could be a nightmare for security reasons, and also because winter is coming up. It's going to make it hard for people to get to polling places if there is a runoff.
So let me see if we, maybe I'm going to take about 30 seconds to do this because mm-hmm. we're running out of time. Let me see if I can summarize where we are. Hamid Karzai, a former CIA asset whose brother is an alleged heroin dealer, whose vice president is an alleged heroin dealer, whose government is widely considered to be a narco-state farce held in place only by U.S. money and diplomatic cover.
And troops.
He's accused by numerous credible sources, including Abdullah, of widespread vote fraud. So when it happened in Iran, it was one of the year's biggest stories. In Afghanistan, let's see, U.S. government has been silent, U.S. media, they're silent, U.S. soldiers, they're dying into the indefinite future to defend this travesty. Have I missed anything?
No, I think you got it. I think you summed it up pretty well.
All right. That leaves you about 30 seconds to let us know how the U.S. arms sales are going.
Splendidly. Do I have 25 seconds left? Congressional study coming out this week saying that the U.S. continues to dominate world arms sales in 2008. $37.8 billion for the U.S., up from $25 billion in 2007. That's 68% of all global sales. Second place was Italy with less than one-tenth as much, $3.7 billion. Russia is third. A lot of the reason this is happening, Bush giving away the store with the way this works, the U.S. gives credit to foreign governments to then turn around and use the money to buy it from U.S. arms dealers. So basically, Bush is giving away U.S. money to the arms dealers funneled through third world governments, and made a lot of his friends rich on his way out of office in 2008, and a lot of people died as a result.
All right.
And will continue to die as a result.
Any events for this week?
One to speak of, Friday the 18th, a fundraiser for Coffee Strong, the GI Coffee House outside Fort Lewis. That'll be at Puget Ridge Co-Housing at 7020 18th Avenue Southwest. And if you didn't have something to write that address down with and the details, the information is at www.givoice.org.
All right. Talking as we do every week, the Job Parish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
You can find Eat the State around town, where you find other free periodicals in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, in the King County Library System carries us to. And you can also find us online at www.eatthestate.org.